Believers know that we always teach and preach better than we actually live. This is a non-negotiable. So character matters simply because if we're going to follow Jesus, we've got to increasingly look like Jesus.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to Food Trucks in Babylon, a Western Seminary podcast. My name is Ryan Lister, and I'm with
Todd Miles.
Good to have you here with us, even though you're not doing anything right now. Today, our guest is pastor and author Aaron Minnikoff to help us think about the importance of the fruit of the Spirit in pastoring God's people. Aaron is the pastor of Mount Vernon Baptist Church in Atlanta, Georgia, and he's the author of the book Character Matters, Shepherding and the Fruit of the Spirit, which will be at the center of our conversation today. Join us as Aaron shows us why character is vital for Christian ministry, particularly in a post-Christian world.
Aaron, it's so good to have you with us. Would you mind introducing yourself to our audience?
Absolutely. My name is Aaron Minnikoff. I was born in Hawaii. I hail from the great state of Oregon.
Go Ducks.
The fighting ducks, not the mighty ducks, Todd. Okay.
Yes. And I have a story about that, by the way, but yeah.
But I am very familiar with Corvallis, and I spent after college at the University of Oregon, I spent a number of years in DC. For your Portland audience, I worked for Mark Hatfield. So the courthouse that was didn't do so well the past few months, that was the guy that I worked for.
Named after, back in the olden days when Oregon elected conservative people occasionally.
Back in the olden days, yes. And, Mark Hatfield was certainly a progressive Republican, but pro-life, anti-Vietnam War, fascinating figure, lovely man. Died a few years ago, mm-hmm. and but I got to work for him in D.C. before eventually. So he was a member of, at the time, Capitol Hill Metropolitan Baptist Church with his wife Antoinette, mm-hmm. and that's where I started going to church, and that's where I met Mark E. Dever, the new pastor. Okay. And so I went from working for Mark Hatfield to Mark Dever, okay. And I say just with great respect and joy, there's two just wonderful Christian men that I've had the privilege of working for. And so that was in the late 90s before I headed off to Louisville. And then in 2008, made my way to the city too busy to hate, Atlanta, Georgia.
Okay. Yeah. And we met when you were at Southern Seminary, and I was grading your papers because I was a grad assistant for Bruce Ware.
That's right. And in fact, and I think you must have broken some policy, but you were promoting the beavers in some of your comments on my papers.
Yes. I was just trying to be pastoral as a teaching assistant and write private notes to the students of encouragement, things like not bad for a duck.
Right. Well, so. I felt seen. I felt known.
Yes.
And you also helped me get a job that really, provided for my family at the a classical school there. Mm-hmm. That was a real joy too. So
yeah. I'm still waiting for that headhunter fee.
Right. Well, keep waiting.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Aaron, tell us about your ministry in Atlanta right now. What are you doing there?
Yeah, I pastor Mount Vernon Baptist Church, mm-hmm. in just north of Atlanta, and this is a church that was founded in 1959. It's a church that has been in friendly cooperation with and contributing toward the causes of the Southern Baptist Convention. It's a church that's seen a lot of change in its history, a lot of humbling over the years, and a lot of growth. They took a risk on me about a dozen years ago when I came to pastor here, and And we are just about the business of seeking to faithfully proclaim God's word in a city that really is changing. People's views of the world seem to be changing at a record pace. And our message isn't changing as a church, but our world is definitely changing. And so I knew that I really, you know, I wanted to be in a place, I wanted to be in a city. Atlanta is definitely that. And it's been quite a culture shock for me, certainly when I first got here, coming and living in the South. But I think that there's something to be said for being a pastor from a different culture, coming into a different culture. Perhaps I was able to say some things or do some things that would have been less well received by someone who grew up in the church or in the culture.
Yeah. What were some of those cultural spots that you're talking about, those shocks for you?
Well, you know, Atlanta is a city with numerous mega churches. I mean, they're just a dime a dozen. It's just such a church going population, or at least a population that valued church membership. And so growing up in the secular Pacific Northwest, growing up without any background in the church. I mean, when I was a high school student, I could not have told you the difference between Billy Graham and Jimmy Swaggart. I'm not sure your listeners will know who Jimmy Swaggart is, but prosperity gospel, not an ethical televangelist. And so I think I was able to address nominal Christianity, recognizing that, in all honesty, I don't understand why would anyone proclaim Jesus and then not give his or her life 100% for Jesus. I'm not saying I was doing that perfectly, but I didn't have a category for people who would just dip their toe into Christianity. It just made no sense to me. And yet so much of Southern religion is just that. And that's what I mean by perhaps I was able to speak with a little greater clarity coming from a different culture.
I'm sure that's super helpful. Could you tell us just briefly how you came to know the Lord, just given what you've already said about your background?
Yeah, I liked a girl in high school.
The Lord's always working.
Yep. And so one evening, as part of a class assignment, we went to see a play. The play was Cyrano de Bergerac. Somehow, in God's providence, we had these seats that enabled us to talk during the play. And I literally discovered that evening that she was a Christian. And I was shocked because she was the smartest girl in school, and everybody knew that. Mm. Everything I learned about Christianity, I learned from television. And I knew nothing about, you know, R.C. Sproul. I knew nothing about church history. Just, I didn't know about these brainiacs, you know, who could really defend the faith.
Yeah.
And when she told me that she was a Christian, I was blown away. And then I asked her the question. I said, "Well, do you think I'm going to hell?" And she said to me that night, "Aaron, if this is what you believe," meaning, you know, nothing, "and if this is how you live your life," meaning for yourself and not for Christ, "then yes, I think you're going to hell." And her boldness, I'd say God really used her boldness. I'm not saying I was converted in that moment, but all of a sudden I now had a category for someone who believed things that she couldn't prove and lived a very attractive life. And that was my senior year in high school. And a few months later, I believe I truly repented and believed. And I began going to a Foursquare church, both in Beaverton, Oregon, which was Ron Mell was the pastor there. He died of leukemia a number of years ago.
Famously, actually, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
After Jack Buford, on his radio show, chronicling, his dying process. But it was profoundly effective and moving to so many people who listened during that time.
Yeah, when he preached as a young man, as a boy, I would feel like he was preaching directly to me. I mean, there was a lot about that church that was, you know, I'd look back and say it was not very healthy, but I definitely heard the gospel there.
Yeah. Excellent.
And I was grateful for that.
That's great. Well, that you talk about that conversion experience a bit in your new book.
Yeah.
Character Matters, Shepherding in the Fruit of the Spirit. And that's kind of the book we want to dive in and talk to you more about today, as well as other things. Hopefully we'll have some fun here. But tell us just briefly how this book came about. Where is it coming from? What motivated you to write this book?
Yeah, a dear brother that is still on staff with me. He was about to be nominated by the elder body at Mount Vernon to be an elder. And at the time, he worked for me as a pastoral assistant. And we have a yearly review. And one of the questions is something like, you know, are there any ways that I can serve you better as your supervisor? And he was very candid. And he said, you know, Aaron, he said it in writing, Aaron, I'm not sure that I can serve with you as an elder, because often in conversation with you, you can be harsh and therefore intimidating. and I know you can't help but chuckle, but in all honesty, I never would have said about myself that I was harsh. I had always compared myself, I suppose, to other people. And I thought, well, compared to them, not harsh at all. And that led me, with the help of some friends at Nine Marks, to write an article on gentleness or meekness, where I reflected on the reality that both the value of being gentle, but also on this fact that you don't always know what you're struggling with. Yeah. Without some careful self-examination and a little help from your friends, you don't always know what you need to be working on. And that led me to, you know, meditate on the other pieces of the fruit of the Spirit from Galatians 5. And eventually the articles seemed helpful enough to enough people that it turned into a book proposal and ultimately the book.
Excellent. Excellent. So, speaking to the church in America, how urgent is character formation? How urgent is developing the fruit of the Spirit in the pastorate right now in 2021?
Well, I'm loath to say it's more urgent than it's ever been. I've studied enough church history to argue against that. However, it is interesting how much attention, and I think rightfully so, that we're paying to the character of our leaders, whether you think back to the Me Too movement a few years ago and just the horrific, detrimental, satanic leadership of people in Hollywood or in the media. You think to politics and all of our attention, most of our attention is on the public scandals. And yet Jesus says in Luke 6:40 that the disciple would become like his teacher. And I take Jesus at his word that thousands upon thousands of congregations, which really are the world's only hope, thousands and thousands of congregations are going to some degree reflect the doctrine and the character of their pastors. And in that sense, even though the book, the thesis is not very complicated at all, pastors are in desperate need of reclaiming this this simple truth that, you know, they need to watch both their life and their doctrine and their life. And I suppose if there's any urgency, it's both the recognition that there are great temptations in the 21st century towards pride, towards self-promotion, that we need to be working against quite deliberately, because I think every generation does face new challenges. And then secondly, we're not in a culture that promotes self-examination or reflection. And in that sense, our generation is at a disadvantage if we've lost the discipline of quietly opening our Bibles, staring at it, meditating on it, And then after asking, what does it say about God? After asking the question, you know, how does this help me understand my Savior and his gospel better? You know, finally asking the question, you know, how do I need to change as a result of what I'm reading in the Word today?
Yeah. Well, I mean, and you touched on it a little bit just a second ago regarding how it's important for a pastor's character to be defined and developed and transformed as it affects their congregation. This is a book, just sort of straightforward, it's a book for pastors. How is it also a book for congregations or Christians at large?
There is, certainly it's for pastors because they are the target. Pastors and church leaders, missionaries, seminary professors have unusual influence. And so I think it's appropriate to remind them of that influence, to remind them of, like I said, Luke 6:40, you know, James, you know, warns those who would become teachers because they're going to be held to a greater accountability. But at the same time, Galatians 5, which is basically the text of the book, it is not for pastors. It's for Christians. Right. Yeah. And every believer has a responsibility to examine their own heart. Because at the end of the day, if you're not producing, you know, the fruit of the Spirit, you have no reason to call yourself a Christian.
Yeah. You say that, you say this is a book about sanctification. So what do you mean by that? So help us think through, what does that mean? What does that look like?
Well, of course, we know that justification is the act of God declaring us righteous. It's a definitive act. It's a one-time act. And that is a crucial message. And so I loved thinking about the Reformation, you know, a few years ago, especially as we were celebrating the Reformation and the doctrines of sola fide. We know that if justification has taken place in our lives, inevitably we will change. And so I wanted to write a book that reflected pastorally for pastors on the intricate work of the Holy Spirit in our lives. And when I say intricate, I simply mean if the act of sanctification is growing in godliness, and if God is infinitely holy, our reflection upon our own holiness has so many different facets and so many different aspects. And the fruit of the Spirit is such a beautiful window into the character of God, which is on display in the lives of his children. And so at the end of the day, it's simply a book on sanctification. And I wanted to make that clear. And we must not think about our justification without paying due attention to our sanctification, because of course our sanctification is the evidence that we have been truly born again.
Right. One of the things you say in the book, it's sort of building out of that sanctification idea, is that sanctification, and this was, you know, this is a little shocking, I think, probably most who will read it, but sanctification requires rest. Help us understand what you mean by that, because most people think, okay, justification has been taken care of for us. Sanctification is now what we do. But you're saying it requires rest, specifically rest in Christ. So what do you mean, and how do we do that?
Well, I mean, on one hand, I simply mean to teach what Jesus explained when he says that he is the vine and we are the branches and we are to abide in him that we might bear fruit. That abiding is trusting, it's resting, it's savoring, it's treasuring. It's all those things that I hope we're hearing from the pulpit. But, you know, every Christian tends to lean one direction or the other. Some Christians lean so much into this idea of resting. It's sort of like I'm going to I'm going to rest in who Jesus is. I'm going to rest in what he's done. And I just know that he's going to do a great work. Other Christians, they lean into, I need to fight for my holiness. And they're probably going to avoid slowing down, recognizing, you know, fundamentally, theologically, the Spirit does the work. And so depending on where you lean, you're probably going to need to have one aspect of our side of sanctification emphasized, the resting side or the fighting side. But both are crucial.
That's good. Yeah.
We had talked about this earlier about, you know, you said, I'm not willing to say that it's more important, you know, growth in character for the pastor than it's ever been. But I do remember a time, I'm not that old. I do remember a time where if you were a pastor, that was highly respected, in cities and towns. Mm-hmm. Not so much anymore. Mm-hmm. Is there a sense in this post-Christian culture that we live in where pastoral integrity, growth in sanctification, is important just to establish some credibility that you didn't have to establish before?
Yeah, that's a great question, Todd. And I do think it still depends. I mean, America is a big country. There's a lot of people. There are regional differences. I do pastor in the South, and where I do think pastors are still held in a kind of esteem, that in conversations with friends who pastor in the Pacific Northwest or maybe New England, it's a little bit different. Of course, New England was once the Bible Belt of America, and that's no longer the case. You know, let me say two things about that. Just one, theologically, you know, Peter tells us that the world is going to speak evil of us because of what we believe. Let them at least not speak evil of us because of how we live. At least can we do that? And Peter says that's a huge component of our Christian witness, is how we live. But let me say something perhaps to key in on your point about this cultural moment. So I've been in ministry for about 25 years, and I'm no longer young, but sort of part of that young restless reform movement. When I was younger, a couple of decades ago, when I thought about people who fell out of ministry, the people that came to my mind were the Jimmy Swaggarts. In other words, folks whose theology was already suspect. Mm-hmm. And okay, Back then, it was pretty easy for me to say, aha, that's what happens when your theology is crooked. You know, that's what happens. You're not going to be sanctified. I don't know that I was never writing that. I don't know how consciously I was thinking about it. But I would say that as I've been in ministry longer, I have seen men who dotted all their theological I's and crossed all of their theological T's accurately. Mm. And yet I saw them one by one falling out of ministry. And I think that was a bit of a wake-up call for me. I think somewhere, even though I knew Paul told Timothy, watch your life and your doctrine, in the back of my mind, I thought really good doctrine is really protective.
Okay.
And it's just not sufficient. It's not sufficient. That good doctrine rightly embraced is going to lead you to be suspect of your own motives and awfully careful about your own life.
Well, one of the things I found very, very helpful in this book is that each of the fruits of the Spirit, you consistently tie back to, and you spoke about it earlier, tie back to the character of God. And so I'm wondering, one of the questions that kept floating around is having the Spirit developing these fruits in us, these character mm-hmm. traits. Mm-hmm. And you say, actually, it's one fruit with many expressions. Mm-hmm. Is that just another way of saying we are being conformed to the image of the Son? Is that the same thing or?
Ryan, I believe it is the same thing. Okay. I believe the Father and the Son and the Spirit are marvelously at work in our lives. And by the power of the Spirit, we are presently being transformed from one degree of glory to another. Mm-hmm. And I think that this whole idea of bearing fruit is, I mean, I just praise God for the beauty and the clarity of the Bible. So if someone wonders, Paul, what are you saying in 2 Corinthians chapter 3? I'm being transformed from one degree of glory to another. Well, hop on over to John 15 and listen to Jesus talk about bearing fruit. Hop on over to Galatians 5 and listen to Paul explain that this is what it means to keep in step with the Spirit. It's to grow in love and in joy and in peace and in patience and in kindness and in goodness and in gentleness and in faithfulness and in self-control. And that is, in a nutshell, that is holiness. And I certainly, even as I talk about it, I always want to be so careful because, you know, Christians, we're all so tempted to lean in one direction or the other. And I don't know if I say it in the book, but I think if we went back to the fourth century, people would have said really great things about the character of Arius, the pastor of Alexandria. But I would argue few men led the church into greater disrepair and maybe even paved the way for Islam than Arius. So, you know, we need to be careful. We need to attend to our doctrine. But by God's grace, if we bear spiritual fruit, we are simply growing in holiness.
Well, let's take a quick break and then we'll come back right after this and think about food truck questions from Portland for Aaron.
Oh, can I have a bento box?
Hey, my name's Justin, and I'm in the Master of Divinity program through Western Seminary's Global Campus. One of the things I've loved about studying at the Global Campus is the online live class format. In an online live class, I have the flexibility to study from anywhere, but also a chance to interact in real time with my professors and the other students in the class once a week. To learn more about Western, visit westernseminary.edu. Now, back to the show.
All right. Well, welcome back. We are here with Aaron Minnikoff, who has written a wonderful and very helpful book called Character Matters, Shepherding in the Fruit of the Spirit. Now, Aaron, one of the things that we try to do on this podcast, we were hoping to do it with the people involved from the food trucks from Portland, coming from sort of a post-Christian band, asking them the direct questions. Fortunately, a pandemic has gotten in the way of those things.
No.
So we're kind of asking those questions for them. And we think, you know, a lot of people would see this the title of this book from outside the church, and they would just ask you broadly, what in the world do you mean by character? Why does it matter? And why do churches and pastors matter given all the bad they've produced in the world? I know there's a lot of questions, I could walk you through that, but
no, that's okay. It's, you know, it's funny. The Originally, the book was going to be titled simply like Shepherding in the Fruit of the Spirit. And, you know, for good or for ill, I wanted something a little punchier. I wanted something a little stronger. But it is a difficult book to promote in the sense that, you know, once you put up a book, character matters, whether you're the author or someone who is, you know, encouraging people to read it, immediately you can feel like there's a target on your back. Because, you know, especially... believers know that we always teach and preach better than we actually live.
Yep.
And yet we know that that this is a non-negotiable. At least we should know that this is a non-negotiable. So character matters simply because if we're going to follow Jesus, we've got to increasingly look like Jesus. And the fact that we're not glorified, you know, does not mean that's not an excuse to stop longing and striving to represent him well on earth. And so one aspect of bearing God's image as redeemed sinners is striving to be holy and to have a godly character. So to, you know, we used to speak more in terms of virtues. Virtue really isn't a word that people use as much anymore. I think it sounds awfully Victorian or kind of old school. Character has more kind of like street cred, and we all know what that means. And I think the moment your pastors and your congregations are known for lacking character, that's the moment that they're just less attractive, you know? And I think, you know, we're witnessing that, you know, I don't want to, you know, go off into the political field right now, but to the extent that Christianity is publicly associated with individuals who don't represent Christ well, but are publicly affirming of Christianity, that just makes evangelism harder. I mean, in my own family, it's very difficult even sometimes to talk with my own dad. He's not a believer. He's Jewish, and it's very difficult for him to disassociate Christianity with politics.
Don't you do a podcast with him?
And so my dad and I, so my dad is 82 years old, and he is a retired English professor. He lives in Hawaii. I live in Atlanta. And so a couple of years ago, we started Island Idols, IDYLLS, where I basically ask him a bunch of questions about literature. And then we try to talk about life as well. And that's where sort of the differences come out. But I want, you know, I certainly, you know, my dad knows that I want him to find my faith attractive. And part of the attractiveness of Christianity is its ability to explain the world in which we live. I think that's a really attractive feature of Christianity. I think it is the best. I think its explanatory power is compelling. But I think it's also compelling to see the lives of genuine Christians. And so, yeah, this book, Character Matters, is pushing in that second direction.
Well, let's get back into the book just a bit more. You say that you really can't pastor well if you're not bearing spiritual fruit, if you're not growing in holiness and godliness. But how do you keep from getting discouraged? Because there's this pesky world, the flesh, and the devil. Isn't it true that God works in spite of us and not because of us?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's absolutely true that God works in spite of us. It's absolutely true that when we preach and when we counsel, when we disciple, we do so as broken vessels. You know, Paul says that the treasure of the gospel has been put in jars of clay so that the power of God might be on display. I think perhaps there can be confusion. To promote this idea of character, godliness, is not to conclude you've arrived. It's just to argue, you know, I'm on my way, you know, and, you know, I'm not the man I once was. And if the congregation can't see the pastor's struggle with sin and growth in godliness, inevitably, to go back to this compelling language, inevitably, the message he's preaching is going to be slightly less compelling. I don't want to take anything away from the objective power of the gospel, right? So Paul tells the Philippians, you know, whether from false motives or true, so long as the gospel is proclaimed. Well, how can he say that? Because at the end of the day, it's not the character of the preacher that saves the people. At the end of the day, it's the truthfulness of the message we proclaim. And yet, to neglect your life is to defame the gospel. And that's why this topic is so important.
Why do you think it's so easy to overlook character? For pastors, I mean, could be that you're going a million miles a second or thinking externally consistently. What's the reason or reasons for overlooking that emphasis on character?
Okay, well, taking off the table for a moment, the noetic effects of the fall and the reality that our minds just don't work the way they ought to work. And so inevitably we're going to miss things. I want to say that as a man who is getting older, if you asked me 20 years ago, the particular sins I struggle with, I wouldn't skip a beat. I would say pride. I would say lust. And I would say laziness. And I'm thinking of a young Christian in my 20s. And then as time goes on, I'm not saying, you know, I saw, you know, profound victory in each of these areas. But as time went on, you know, by God's grace and with the help of my brothers and sisters in Christ, those struggles, they didn't go away. But I saw growth. But getting back to my friend challenging me about harshness, I know in my own life, somewhere along the way, I wasn't paying careful attention to other areas of my life that needed attention. And so I was reading, I must have read Galatians 5, but I wasn't necessarily asking myself the question. And guys, perhaps I'm just confessing my own weakness, but I read about gentleness, but I didn't stop and say, hey, how am I doing in this area? And that's my answer to your question. Sometimes if you've got yourself pigeonholed, if you think you know yourself really well, you might begin taking it easy on yourself or simply focusing on a few problem areas to the neglect of others. And Galatians 5:22, it's not an exhaustive list. There's no mention, for example, of compassion, you know, in that passage. And yet compassion is another piece of the fruit of the Spirit that we're to have. Mercy isn't mentioned there. The Bible is so amazing. And there's so many opportunities to explore your heart. And that's, I think, what every Christian is to do.
I mean, and I think that's really, really helpful. Oftentimes, you know, personally, I find myself that the sin that, you know, is demonstrating the most light, that you miss everything else because you're focused on that one issue. And then, you know, by God's grace, that light goes down and then you begin to see the other problems. Help us understand how we can avoid despairing in that. Where's the hope? Where does that come from in the midst of, you know, evaluating our hearts from a biblical perspective?
Well, speaking about pastoral ministry, I know this applies to every Christian, but somewhere in the book, I say that my favorite part of the week is basically Friday at 5 o'clock, and not because the workday is done, but because that's the moment when I hope I'm putting the finishing touches on Sunday morning sermon. And that's the moment where I am most poignantly reflecting inevitably on the doctrine of justification by faith alone. Even though that sermon will have addressed issues of sanctification, I hope right and left, that's really, oddly enough, it's not where I end. I end thinking about what Christ accomplished at Calvary. It's very difficult to lose hope when you recognize that, you know, Jesus paid it all. And that is a deeply encouraging truth. And there is no other well to draw upon that truth than the well of Christianity. And that's why I don't, you know, that's why it's not that, you know, I don't have days where I wish I pray I'd have more joy or, you know, it's, you know, certainly we're all going to battle discouragement at times, but, you know, by God's grace, the cross is the heartbeat of my life.
That's good. So, there are lots of classes you can take on homiletics at seminary. There are conferences. There's Simeon Trust. Not so much in aiding the character of a pastor. So, which is more important? If forced choice, either or, great preaching skills or great character in a pastor?
Well, Todd, I don't like that question.
You don't like to choose.
It was a forced choice.
Well, seminary teaches you to say both and.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I would rather have the true gospel preached from an ungodly man than a false gospel preached from a supposedly godly man. You know, I mean, absolutely, because it's the power of the gospel. I just recognize that that the Bible would not have us choose. The Bible would have every aspiring pastor, every pastor lean into with all of his heart, soul, mind, and strength, God and the holiness that he requires of us.
Cites biblical authority to refuse to answer my question.
That's incredible. That's good pastor. So what character attribute or fruit of the Spirit is most lacking, or maybe pick two here, is most lacking in the church's leadership today?
All right. You asked me this question. It depends on the hour of the day. But let me suggest let me just suggest that patience and faithfulness right now should be the cry, the battle cry of every church. Every church should be crying out, give me a patient pastor. Give me a faithful pastor. Give me a pastor who's patient with me, who doesn't expect me to be the perfect member today. Give me a pastor who understands that I'm a work in progress. Give me a congregation that's willing to be patient with the pastor. How many congregations, you know, chew up their pastors because they expect too much of them too soon? So patience, patience, patience. Instead of expecting your congregation to be, you know, 100, 500, 800 people, be patient with the people God's given you and trust him to give the growth. Be faithful. Trust that God's ordained means for growing his church are better than yours. Those are so needed today. But, you know, I'd have to throw in a third one, love. Love. If we don't have love, you know, we don't have anything, Paul says. And give us pastors that genuinely love their congregations. That's a beautiful sight to behold.
And to pull that out of just the pastorate, and you touched on this a little bit with patience, but would those be the same for the congregations for God's people? Would those be the same attributes of fruits of the Spirit that you would say, man, we really need these today? I know it's not just one, but yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't want to push back against the question, but I have to assert that all of these need to be growing. And that's, I think a case could be made that fruit is plural, but I'm making the case that it's singular, at least in Galatians 5, to make the very point that let's be careful not to separate them. I know that as I shepherd a flock, I want the members of my church to have all these things. I do see a lack of peace, you know, as they look at the world, as they see, you know, this podcast is being recorded just a few days after, the Capitol invasion, as they see a country that lacks unity. Maybe as they just have things in their own lives. I mean, there's a young couple in our congregation whose baby is in the hospital with bacterial meningitis. Boy, I just want them to know the peace of the Lord. Not a peace that, you know, causes them to hide or hide from the world, but just reminds them that, you know, a sovereign God is in charge. So I want them to know peace. And I want them to know joy. You know, and I think so often one of the points I make in the book is that so often I see Christians looking for joy like it's a panacea. And I just want to say, stop looking for joy, look for Christ. And I mean, I say that about a lot of things, you know, stop looking for community, look for Christ. But if I were to answer the question about, you know, churches, I want them to know the joy of the Lord. I think that's attractive to an unbelieving world, to just recognize, yeah, we may not know everything. We may not have the best answers to all of your really hard questions, but we are a people who know God, and that's changed us. And it's made us a content people, a joyful people. I think there's something, a peaceful people. I think there's something to be said for that.
Well, I definitely want to circle back to the love question, but since you brought up joy, let's ask. So you say, mm-hmm. stop looking for joy, stop looking for it. Mm-hmm. Why is looking for joy a bad strategy?
And to build out that, what do you mean by joy?
Well, by joy, I mean this settled contentment, the settled happiness that God is your redeemer, that he has accomplished your salvation. In other words, the content of our joy is the finished work of Christ. And really, really in the book, it's the triune work of God. The reason I say stop looking for it is because my observation is that everyone wants to be happy. Everyone wants to be joyful. And we get it in our minds that joy is merely a feeling. And I don't want to say it has nothing to do with your feelings, because I really do think, I mean, when you are joyful, you know, there can be a smile, there can be a laughter. So I don't want to take anything away from that. But I do think that we can make an idol out of joy. We can be so depressed that we don't have joy, that we can cycle downward into a spiral of despair, and longing for joy isn't going to get you out of that pit. Christ is going to get you out of that pit. Marveling at him, at what he's done, at who he is, finding great comfort in great doctrine, that's where joy comes from. And I have really appreciated, I think, a recovery in my generation of the experiential aspect of Christianity. I think we need it. I think we need to be reminded that we need to delight in God and hunger for God and love God. I just think we also need to be reminded that it's not going to come absent a full-throttled pursuit of Christ. I hope that answers your question on the joy.
Well, let's circle back to love really quick. Then,
yeah,
can you pastor well without loving your congregation?
No.
Okay, so
you, excellent. You can't.
How do you grow in love for your congregation?
Well, you know, one of the great bits of counsel that Augustine gave in his book, I think it's on teaching doctrine or on Christian doctrine, he instructed teachers to pray that they would love their class, and that's sage counsel there. Just pray for God's help to love your congregation, know your congregation, you know what they're struggling with. Know what they're enduring. I talk about Ed in the book, a man who it took me years to get to know in my church. And, you know, I called him this morning and checked in with him, and I found out that Ed can no longer walk. I don't love him more because I now know he can no longer walk, but knowing him, knowing his struggles, I can pray for him better. I'm not saying that every pastor needs to know the troubles of every single member. I think for most churches or many churches, that's really hard, but that needs to be our heartbeat. You know, it's very difficult. If the Holy Spirit's in you and you know your congregation, you're going to love them.
Okay. You say in the book, true peace is reconciliation with God. And so that has sort of an objective punch to it. How do you connect the objective and the subjective? Now, you were talking about that out of joy and making that connection. Mm-hmm. How do you do that?
Yeah, it is certainly very similar to that idea of joy. I think there's overlap. You know, I think love, in a sense, is the first, you know, virtue that's mentioned for a reason. Sort of it seems to be the gateway. Your love for God, God's love for you, your love for others is going to help you be gentle. I think self-control at the very end is there for a reason. you know, before you're done, Paul wants to say, hey, don't forget, in the absence of self-control, it's going to be very difficult to, you know, produce all this other fruit. You're not going to have peace. You're not going to have genuine peace when your world is falling apart, unless you know that that God, that your biggest problem is behind you. And look, I've been a Christian since 1990. I've been in pastoral ministry since 1996. I need to remind myself, Aaron, your biggest problem is behind you. And I don't, that's not like self-help talk. That's, I think that's what, when Martin Lloyd-Jones says, preach the gospel to yourself, I think that's what he means. You know, okay, remember, you know, my debt has been paid. And if my attention is there, and it takes work to keep your attention there. Like Bible reading, devotional reading is hard work. It's not just opening the Bible, reading a paragraph and putting it down. It's recognizing, okay, I need to appropriate this truth so that I can rightly know who God is. And secondly, rightly know who I am. And only when I've done that hard work will peace result. And it's a daily work, right? It's a daily work. So I think when we're told to meditate on the scriptures, I think that's what we're being told to do. You know, saturate yourself both in who God is and in what he's done. And you know, even as I say all this, I think, you know, what Christian at one level doesn't know this? You know, this is not systematic theology 301. But what Christian doesn't need to be reminded of it daily?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So perhaps this will sound like a selfish question directed to a pastor, but how can congregations help and encourage their pastors in the areas of this book? I mean, of course, buy the book, Character Matters, give it to your pastor. But how else? How else can mm-hmm. congregations help and encourage their pastors in growth and godliness? Mm-hmm.
Well, pastor, or as congregations can, as I said a few moments ago, they can be patient with their pastors. I was talking to a young pastor. He texted me, and he was welcoming a person into his church, into the membership process. And the person was commending the ministry, but then, you know, said to the pastor, well, you know, the service is okay, but I know you're young and it will get better. And I think on one hand that Christian was being patient, but I think, you know, there can be a lack of charity when perhaps you're a little bit so forthright with your pastor. And it's so important to recognize that your pastor is a work in progress. I think speaking the truth to your pastor, I mean, you know, pastors do need to be thick-skinned. But I think congregations, members of the church should have the ability to, I don't dare I say criticize their pastor, but share their concerns with their pastor. And if they do that with a flood of encouragement, that's just a beautiful thing, you know? You know, certainly I don't think that the average Christian encourages others enough. But I think it's not merely encouraging to receive well done. It's also, it can be encouraging to say, you know, I have a question about what you said here. I'm not quite sure that's right. Is that me or is it you? That's really encouraging when a pastor sees a member of the church he serves wrestling with the Bible.
Yeah, absolutely. And just being able to actually creative, not only preach about grace, but actually have that grace be the ethos of the church, to actually have it what we're living in and living out of with one another is a huge, huge plus. And a testimony to how our preaching and pastoring is going. So to that end, we've got a ton of pastors in our audience. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to ask you a few questions sort of in rapid fire form, if you're okay with that.
Yep.
So the first one would be, why do you highlight the fruits of the Spirit to bring about change and transformation rather than say, maybe more what the world would say, like the Enneagram? Why the fruits of the Spirit and not the Enneagram?
Because it's so patently biblical. Yes. It's directly what Paul.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I mean it's exactly what Paul said. He said it repeatedly. It's easy to understand. I just want to err on the side of, I just want my Christian life to be as closely tied to the Bible as I possibly can. And there's a wealth to work with there.
You've spoken a lot about patience. What do you say to the pastor who it just seems like he gets everything he desires the first few years, blessed with extraordinary success, at least in his own eyes?
Mm-hmm. Recognize that it's though God has probably given you some extraordinary gifts, those gifts are from God. You were made by him. You were made for him. Give him the glory. Don't take the credit for yourself. Be careful that you're building on the foundation of the gospel and not the foundation of your own gifts. Have people around you immediately who are going to help point you to the cross repeatedly. So that you are ready. And who knows? I mean, there have been in history extraordinary ministries. And I think that's the exception. It's not the rule.
You do a really great job of talking about pursuing longevity in your ministry in churches. How do you know, though, when it's the right time to leave a church?
Well, I can't. I don't know for sure. But I do know that it's probably not the right time if you can't be confident that the church is going to be left in good hands. You don't let your child get a driver's license until you're confident he's able to drive. The fact that he's 16 doesn't mean that he should automatically get a license.
This is true. I have a few.
Those of us with teenagers can attest to that. Likewise, you know, every congregation needs to know what to look for in a pastor, needs to be at a place where they're ready to call and bring on the right man. And so I think that's the key.
Opposite question to the one I asked earlier. What do pastors do if they don't want their character formed? They're like burnout. They're just working on fumes.
That's a really hard question. As I wrote the book, I knew that a lot of pastors would maybe get to the end of it and be really discouraged. Even though, you know, I try to point people to the gospel again and again and again. If there's very little fruit in your ministry, if you're tired, I can't guarantee that you should be in ministry. I don't know, you know, but I do know that God would have you be in a context where there are godly men and women who are able to speak into your life and say, you know, you really should be a pastor. You just need a sabbatical. Or, you know, you're just doing too much. We don't want you to do this much. Or, Pastor, can I ask you some hard questions? And are you spending time in the Word? So those are really nitty-gritty questions that the pastor who's feeling that needs to address with people close to him. And the real problem is, what if there's no one really close to him? And so I would just say, brother pastors, find someone you trust, you know, preferably within your own church to speak into your life that way. We need to be discipled too.
Yeah, the great thing about the importance of the fruit of the Spirit for ministry is that the fruit of the Spirit are important just for everyday Christian living, whether or not you're a vocational pastor.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, we want to end our time here with just sort of focusing on two questions. The first is, what would you change anything about this book post COVID, post our political climate, our current cultural moment? Would there be anything that you would change?
I would add a study guide.
Okay. That's right.
That's a really, you know, no one has asked me that question. It is certainly not a perfect book, but I genuinely said what I wanted to say. And you ask about this particular cultural climate. I have been loath. I mean, there have been moments when I've wanted to like tweet the cover of my book, you know, but what good is that? That's just, you know, I think this is a helpful book for every single pastor to read. And I'm not apologetic about believing that. I don't think it's a book to correct non-Christians with. I mean, you know, by all means, try it, you know, but my heart's for the church. And by God's grace, I said what I wanted to say, or at least what I knew to say.
I think it was exceptionally helpful, even as I was thinking through it, through the lens of pastoring, through the pandemic, through the political, landscape that we're in. And so one last question here, and hopefully it's a summarizing question. That is, how do we define pastoral success?
Pastoral success is faithfully sharing and modeling and proclaiming the gospel week after week with no earthly hope of material success, but every reason to expect your heavenly reward. And there's nothing I'd rather give my life to than that. There's a lot I'd like to do, but there's nothing I'd rather give my life to than that.
Amen. That's great. It's a great place to end. Thank you.
Yeah. Aaron Minnikoff, thank you, my friend, so much for joining us on Food Trucks in Babylon. We want to encourage everyone listening, go out and get Character Matters, Shepherding in the Fruit of the Spirit. Aaron was kind enough to give us a couple of copies to give away, and so we'll have information on that if you follow us on social media. But Aaron, thanks so much.